Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Adam Cole, a production assistant here. In the first half of this week's show, we've got stories about the brain. Traumatic brain injuries are common for modern soldiers, and some spend months in brain fitness centers rebuilding mental muscles. Others head to mock battlefields, testing if they are ready to return to combat. And in the second half of the program, new species. We'll hear about destructive new species in San Francisco Bay, foreign invaders who are dramatically changing the estuary ecosystem. And we'll learn about a newly discovered group of fungus-like species that defy classification. But first, real-life mind reading. Every time we wiggle a toe or form a thought, our brain is using electrical signals, and these signals literally broadcast what the brain is doing at any moment. Now, scientists are figuring out how to eavesdrop on this broadcast using a computer connected directly to the brain. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, the approach is revealing new information about how we control our muscles, listen to sounds, and communicate.
What's making all this possible is actually an old technology. It's called electrocorticography, or ECOG. Surgeons place electrodes on the surface of the brain. Those electrodes detect the brain's electrical signals and send them to a computer running special software. That's the new part. Gerwin Schalk is a researcher at the Wadsworth Center in Albany, New York, who helped design that software. He says the system can decode brain signals so precisely that it can tell whether you're thinking of the word bat or cat.
This is both very exciting and somewhat frightening at the same time, because it really goes pretty close to what people used to call mind reading.
ECOG, minus the software, has been around since the 1950s. Doctors use it to figure out which part of the brain is causing seizures in people with severe epilepsy. About a decade ago, a small group of scientists wondered whether the technology might be able to do something a lot more sophisticated.
Corey, can you close the hand for me, please? That's great, thank you.
Perhaps ECOG could pick out the brain signals we use to control our fingers, or even the signals our brain sends out when we just think about moving our fingers. Schalk shows me a video. In it, he's working with a young man who is staring intently at a computer screen. The video was shot by the American Museum of Natural History as part of an exhibit on the brain.
Can you open it back up? Okay, keep it open.
What's striking about this scene is that the young man's own hand isn't moving. What is moving is a virtual hand on the computer screen. The man is clenching and unclenching this virtual fist on command using only his thoughts.
Close it, close it, close it. Great job.
Like all volunteers in ECOG experiments so far, this patient has severe epilepsy. He took part in the experiment while doctors were using ECOG to find the source of his seizures. But the experiment shows how the technology could help a very different sort of patient, someone paralyzed by a spinal injury or Lou Gehrig's disease. ECOG could allow someone like that to operate a robotic arm with just their thoughts. Schalk says the experiment also shows how much of the brain gets involved in things we take for granted.
Even for simple functions such as opening and closing the hand, for example, there are many, many areas that contribute to the movement.
Bionic arms are just one likely use for ECOG, though. Eric Luthard is a brain surgeon at Washington University in St. Louis who has worked closely with Schalk. He says the technology has proved to be far more powerful and versatile than anyone expected.
I'd say every couple weeks we find something that really kind of makes us scratch our head and say, wow, that's pretty neat.
Luthard says ECOG hits a sweet spot between two competing approaches to detecting brain signals. One of these requires placing electrodes deep in the brain. That allows scientists to monitor individual brain cells with great precision, but they can't monitor very many brain cells at the same time. Another approach is to put electrodes on the scalp, but the signals are much less clear because they pass through skin and bone. Luthard says ECOG involves surgery, but not going into the brain itself.
We basically do what's called a craniotomy, where we make an incision in the scalp, make a large window of bone, we put the array over the brain, we close everything back up, and then there's wires exiting through the skull and through the scalp, which then get directly connected to a computer.
In theory, researchers could receive signals from hundreds or even thousands of electrodes. So far, they haven't gone beyond dozens, yet the results have been spectacular. Schalk shows some of what ECOG can do in his lab. No animals or test tubes here, but there are plenty of computers, including one playing music.
The music is The Wall by Pink Floyd.
Schalk is showing me the results of experiments he did using ECOG to monitor people as they listened. He points toward two waveforms on the computer screen. One shows the mountains and valleys that represent changes in the music volume. The second waveform looks almost the same, but it represents the electrical signals generated by the brain in response to the music.
This is the actual loudness in the music, the decoded loudness in the music. Okay? Very close correlation between the actual loudness in the music that is just playing right now and the music, the intensity of the music that we're decoding or inferring from the person's brain. I mean, isn't that pretty awesome?
Schalk says the brain signal is so distinctive you could almost recognize the music from the waveform alone. What's really awesome, though, is the next part of the experiment.
So what we did was we played some music to the subjects, and then we played the same music again, except that now every about 10 seconds, there was a one-second silence period. All was just in
the wall. Silence in the room, but not in the brain. Even when the music stops, the waveform from the brain continues. All in all it was just a brick in the wall. Schalk says what we're seeing is the brain's attempt to fill in the missing sounds.
The brain basically tells us a lot of information about the music in the times when there's really no music. It's not played.
Whether it's musical phrases or strings of words or scenery we look at, our brains are always filling in missing information. Schalk says ECOG is also revealing things about how the brain creates speech. He and other researchers are using the technology to watch the brains of people as they speak out loud and also as they say the words silently to themselves.
One of the surprising initial findings coming out of that research was that actual and imagined speech is very, very different.
Schalk says when your brain wants you to say a word, it produces two sets of signals. One has to do with moving your muscles.
And that makes sense. First, you have to move your mouth around and your vocal tract around so as to produce a particular type of verbal output.
And there are also signals coming from the auditory system. On the other hand, when a person simply thinks of a word instead of saying it, there are no muscle signals, just the activity in the parts of the brain involved in listening.
And that seems to suggest that what imagined speech actually really is, it's more like internally listening to your own voice.
So it should be possible to use ECOG to decode what we're actually thinking. Schalk says he hasn't quite done that yet, but he's close. In one experiment, the system tried to recognize several dozen unspoken words in the minds of volunteers. It was right about half the time. John Hamilton, NPR News.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell. Just like an old-time movie about a ghost from a wishing well.
And you can see more of those experiments, including a video of a patient controlling a virtual hand with his mind, on our website, npr.org. Exploding roadside bombs have left so many soldiers with concussions that mild traumatic brain injury, or TBI, has become the signature injury of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The condition can be difficult to diagnose and to treat, and determining if and when a soldier can return to battle after a TBI has befuddled doctors. Now physicians at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, are observing patients under the simulated stress of combat. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has the story.
Jesus. Okay.
An explosion catches Sergeant Joshua Thurman by surprise as he and a team of recovering soldiers sweep a gravel road for explosives at a training site on Fort Campbell. Armed with paintball guns, they take periodic fire from pretend insurgents. The last time most of these veterans heard bomb blasts and gunshots was the day they almost died in Afghanistan.
Man in the 50 cal, and there was an explosion, and the concussion got me. And came to find out I did have a TBI, but I also lost the hearing in my left ear.
Hearing loss alone may keep Thurman from going back to the front line, but the lingering effects of a concussion also get in the way for soldiers. Memory loss, mood swings, and balance problems make returning to duty after a TBI difficult, but not impossible. Between each battlefield simulation, physical therapist Tamara Moreland tests each soldier's balance.
You put your arms straight out in front of you, close your eyes, 50 steps in place, stay where you stop.
Physical symptoms of TBI tend to get worse under stress. Moreland wants to see how much worse. Until now, returning to duty took a doctor like David Twilley looking at a few charts and signing off. That's changing.
We said soldiers are making life and death decisions, so doesn't it make sense to use demonstrated competence as the standard for returning someone to duty?
Twilley directs Fort Campbell's TBI clinic, singled out as a national model by the Pentagon. Patients here must demonstrate their competence through pencil and paper tests, as well as new real-life exercises. Most soldiers who get to these simulations will return to duty, Twilley says, but some soldiers appear ready to go back on paper when they're really not.
In fact, very recently, had a soldier that really had a desire to stay in, had done well in all of our pencil and pad, our computerized tests, and all of our simulations. But when all of the different sights, sounds, and smells, everything that's related to combat, he just wasn't able to change his focus. He could focus on one thing, but he couldn't really switch when the conditions changed to something else. And that's very important in combat.
The audio of a battle scene, lifted from Saving Private Ryan, is pumped into this black box of a room. A strobe light imitates the flashes of gun muzzles. Three mannequins lie in pools of fake blood, with amputated limbs scattered around them.
All right, Staff Sergeant, we got more than one casualty. Let's go!
Trainer Jeremy Cole watches to see if soldiers can complete a series of tasks in the correct order, even when rattled. They put in chest tubes, tighten tourniquets.
Catch your breath. We're going to need probably blood. You've lost a lot of blood. We're going to need another stretcher.
As the sound goes down and the lights come up, Staff Sergeant Nicholas Smith stands in a pool of red looking at his hands.
I mean, I've had soldier's blood on my hands before, so it's just like, you know, it takes you back there.
There is blood everywhere in this room, and you're saying this is no exaggeration?
When you have a mascot like this, it's everywhere.
The only thing difference is no one's crying. No one's screaming, Mom, or get me out of here. It's the only difference.
That's Sergeant Patrick Cummings, a big guy with a serious face, who says he's surprised by his own reaction.
It kind of brought tears because of just, I was there. I was one of these patients before, and just hit home.
Despite the flashback, Cummings wants to deploy again. As a TBI survivor, he'll be in good company. The Department of Defense estimates roughly 115,000 service members have experienced one of these mind-altering injuries. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Whether they ultimately return home or return to the battlefield, wounded soldiers often spend months in physical therapy to regain strength in their damaged bodies. Now the military is trying something similar for military personnel with injured brains. John Hamilton reports.
About a year ago, during a firefight in Afghanistan, Fred Simpson was knocked unconscious by the explosion of a rocket-propelled grenade. He was also struck by a bullet that shattered his left shin bone. Over the next few months, doctors at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington rebuilt his leg. But Simpson says there wasn't any operation to fix what the explosion had done to his brain.
I would get confused. I had real poor short-term memory, real poor long-term memory for that matter. I had trouble staying focused. Like, I would be talking to somebody, say I'm talking to you, and then I would just kind of drift off.
He would also forget where he was going or whether he'd turned off a burner on the stove. So Simpson started visiting the Brain Fitness Center at Walter Reed. It's not much to look at, a small interior room with half a dozen computers. They run programs that look and sound a bit like video games.
It's time to play Keep Your Eyes Open. I'm going to show you a scene from a movie. Watch carefully and try to remember as many details as you can.
For people like Fred Simpson, these games can be as grueling as any physical workout.
I don't like coming in. But I do, because, I mean, I know it's this, you know, it works. It's beneficial for me.
Simpson does 4 15-minute sessions a day. He says even that can cause headaches and frustration.
Some days you just want to crush the mouse because you just can't get it. You know, it's all in the tip of your mind, but it just won't come. And then sometimes your mind has a breakthrough and you can, you know, really kind of skate through all the exercises.
It's all a lot like physical rehabilitation. Katie Sullivan directs the Brain Fitness Center. She says the idea is to work your brain to the limit.
Just like going to a gym, you could stay here for 30 minutes and not really get a great workout. But sometimes if you push yourself to that threshold that's ideal and optimal for training, you're going to see more benefit.
Sullivan says some of the computer programs are the same ones sold to consumers trying to sharpen their memory or thinking. Others are more ambitious efforts from companies studying how best to strengthen an injured brain. Sullivan says the people using them often tell her about changes for the better.
I feel more confident going out and doing things. I feel a little bit more like myself. I'm thinking maybe a little quicker. I feel a little sharper. All the way to I'm more social now, or my marriage seems a little better.
Sullivan says computer-based training is appealing because soldiers can do it anywhere they have a computer and a connection to the internet. But scientists caution that brain training remains experimental.
These training programs are a work in progress.
Mrzenek is a professor emeritus neuroscientist at UC San Francisco. He's also a co-founder of Posit Science, a company that makes one of the brain training programs used at Walter Reed. Mrzenek says he's confident that brain training, like physical training, is doing something.
Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to be in the tip-top shape they were in before they went over to Afghanistan, let's say. But most of these people can be substantially better. And the critical thing is that we drive them as far in a corrective or normal word direction as we can, even when a complete correction is not possible.
Mrzenek says the effectiveness of most brain training programs hasn't been tested scientifically on normal brains, let alone injured ones. But there are studies underway at Walter Reed and other institutions. Mrzenek says the goal is to find out how much difference a particular program makes and how it compares with other programs.
You don't just evaluate whether or not they improve at the specific tasks that you're training them on. Of course they improve at those. The question is whether they improve in their general abilities that reflect their capacities, their operational abilities, and everyday life. Because if you don't improve that, you've done nothing useful.
Fred Simpson says brain training has been useful for him. His memory and ability to focus have improved enough that he can now travel on his own without worrying about getting lost. And Simpson says he plans to keep training so he'll be able to attend nursing school. John Hamilton, NPR News.
California is cracking down on invasive species, and that could have a big impact on national regulations due out later this year. The state has passed the strictest rules in the country to prevent cargo ships from bringing foreign plants and animals to San Francisco Bay. But as Lauren Summer reports from member station KQED, the standards are so tough, the state may not be able to enforce them.
Trucks and cranes spring into action as a 900-foot container ship docks here at the Port of Oakland. Every year, thousands of ships pass under the Golden Gate, bringing cars, sneakers, computers, and
let's see, we've got 1, 2, 3 exotic organisms, 4 exotic organisms.
Biologist Andrew Cohen of the Center for Research on Aquatic Bioinvasions slogs through a muddy beach in the Eastern Bay Area. He scoops up a clump of seaweed that's home to clams, snails, strange globs.
Those yellow dots are the eggs, the egg mass of a Japanese sea slug, which showed up here a few years ago.
Biologists have found hundreds of invasive species in San Francisco Bay, which Cohen says makes it one of the most invaded estuaries in the world.
Anytime I go out into the bay, there's a reasonable chance I'm going to find something I've never seen in the bay before, something which no one has seen on the Pacific coast before. That's just astonishing.
Most of these invaders arrived as international hitchhikers. Ships that carry cargo on the open ocean have to balance their loads. So, Cohen explains, they fill massive onboard ballast tanks by pumping seawater in at one port and pumping it out at the next.
For a long time, people didn't think too much about this because it was just water. But eventually, we found that we were moving virtually everything that lived in the sea.
Including parasites that cause rashes and the Asian clam that altered the entire food web in San Francisco Bay. California has spent millions trying to get rid of the worst invasive species, but the state's efforts have rarely worked. So the strategy has turned to prevention.
The ballast tanks that we use are right above us.
Inside the Golden Bear, a 500-foot ship at the California Maritime Academy in Vallejo, engineer Bill Davidson switches on the ballast pumps. Davidson is testing new ballast water treatment technology. The idea is pretty simple. Kill the organisms in the water before the ballast is released. The system has two steps. First, the ballast water is filtered, then chlorine is added.
And you take this chlorine and feed it back into the ballast stream, and so that will ideally oxidize or kill any live organisms.
The treatment system neutralizes the chlorine before it's released, which makes it inactive. But getting this system to work is trickier than it seems, because the organisms are very, very small.
So right in your center field of view, that's a tintinnid.
In a lab on the ship, Julie Kuo of Moss Landing Marine Labs looks through a microscope at a tiny cone-shaped plankton. Kuo counts these organisms in water samples from the treatment process, and most importantly, sees if they're dead.
They're kind of sitting there and you don't know if they're alive or dead, you poke them with a probe.
This treatment system is designed to meet international standards that limit the number of living organisms in ballast water. Right now, those standards are voluntary. But California has adopted a rule that's 1,000 times tougher. It applies to all newly constructed ships starting next January. The only problem is the technology to meet California's standard isn't ready.
We recognize that that's a challenge, but There's a good reason we wanted it to be a challenge.
Nicole Dabrowski is with the California agency overseeing the regulation. She says none of the treatment systems being developed can consistently meet California's standards yet. Still, the state is moving ahead with the regulation.
We wanted them to be innovative. We wanted them to think out of the box.
Which would mean ships across the globe would also have to think out of the box. Almost half of all the cargo brought into the U.S. in shipping containers comes in through California ports. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Summer in San Francisco.
Suitcase patch, trunk's already gone. Going to San Francisco, gonna make it my home. Yeah, San Francisco. Please make room for me.
If you think biologists know everything about what lives on the Earth, think again. Scientists say they have just now discovered an entirely new branch on the tree of life. It's made up of mysterious microscopic organisms. They're related to fungus, but they're so different, you could argue that they deserve their very own kingdom alongside plants and animals. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
It was just a few years ago that Tim James and his colleagues sat down and wrote the definitive scientific paper to describe the fungal tree of life.
We thought we knew about the major groups that existed. Many books have excellent drawings of these fungi from, you know, the last 150 years.
James, who is curator of fungus at the University of Michigan, says, of course, many are familiar.
You've got mushrooms, yeast, and molds.
Plenty of plant diseases like rusts and smuts. There's the stuff that grows in your shower or between your toes.
Fungi that specialize on insects, the Entomophthalales.
Even fungi that grow on other fungi. Biologists figure they've probably only cataloged about 10% of all fungal species, but they thought that they at least knew all the major groups. Oops. A paper being published in the journal Nature says not so. Thomas Richards at the Natural History Museum in London says biologists can mostly only study microscopic fungi if they can grow them in the lab.
But the reality is that most of the diversity of the life we can't grow in a laboratory. It exists in the environment.
And microscopic organisms are just about impossible to find just looking in dirt or water through a microscope. So Richards and his colleagues tried more modern means.
About 10 years ago, people started using molecular approaches, so they started to try and target the DNA in the environment specifically.
Using those techniques, they struck pay dirt. They found novel bits of DNA related to fungi but clearly different from all the known varieties, just about everywhere.
Including pond water, lake water, freshwater sediments, in marine sediments. Basically, almost everywhere we looked, we found this novel group.
They then brought samples back to the lab and devised a technique to make the organisms containing this novel DNA glow under a microscope. So they've managed to get a few glimpses of these mysterious life forms, which they've named Cryptomycota.
And we know that they have at least three stages to their life cycle. One is where they attach to a host, which we think are photosynthetic algae. Another stage where they form swimming tails, so they can presumably find food. And another stage, which we call cyst phase, where they go to sleep.
Now, Richards and his colleagues would like to figure out how to grow them in the lab to really get to know them.
At the moment, it's a bit too early to be sure about what role they play in the environment. But one thing we can be certain of is that because they are so diverse, they're probably playing many, many different roles in many different environments.
Back at the University of Michigan, Tim James says the discovery is revolutionary. It's rocking the world of fungus phylogenetics.
It's going to be interesting because one of the controversies is going to be, are they really fungi or not?
Since they apparently lack a protein in their cell walls that is a defining feature of fungi, you could argue that they aren't actually a member of the fungus kingdom, but deserve an entire kingdom of their own. And before you get too comfortable with the idea that all these species just hang out in ponds or sediments,
there could be some actually human parasites in here eventually discovered.
But fret not. Mostly, fungi are doing important things like recycling nutrients. And most of the time, they seem to leave us alone. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And that's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. I'm Adam Cole. Have a great week.